Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? I recently saw a health video he made and I was surprised. He's in his 80s and still seems to have his energy and health. He says he's even stronger, has more stamina, and plenty of energy left over for his grandkids since making one simple health change that helps his digestion and nutrition. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife made the same change and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, and she has energy all day. Many of us do not include the fruits, vegetables, and other herbs that increase health and energy in our own diets. Chuck Norris made a special video that explains how he incorporated these things with one simple product. You can watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/Harris. It may change your approach to your own health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/Harris.
Welcome to the Conversations That Matter cell phone edition, where I share a few quick updates and thoughts with you. I just noticed behind me, you can see a little stocking and there's some Christmas decor. I'm actually looking at my tree. It started to fade into the background. I didn't realize it was still up. And now I'm thinking through it and I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's not supposed to be there. I'm not stuck in December, I promise you. Does anyone else have that issue? You just leave Christmas decorations up? I think my wife likes the Christmas season a lot, which I do too. But we're not stuck. We're moving into 2021, I promise you. And I'm going to give you a few updates on that. Number one, the Discerning Christians website is being beta tested right now, meaning those who are patrons, which, by the way, thank you to all the patrons. You guys, you've done more than you even realize. And it helps significantly in some of the efforts that we're part of here. But one of those is the Discerning Christians website. The patrons are testing it out. They're going to identify kinks. We're going to iron out those kinks, and then we're going to launch the tool for everyone. And basically what the tool does is there's a integrated map where you can put, you know, make a little avatar or a profile, and you can do it for an institution like a church or for yourself, and then it'll show up on a map and people can then link with one another. They can network, and if you're a church planner, you can identify, hey, look, you know, in this town, we'll just say Milwaukee or something, you know, there's 50 people that have signed this particular statement of faith for the Discerning Christians website. They're against the social justice movement. They're for biblical orthodoxy, and they probably don't have a place to worship. Let me connect with them. Let me try to find out who they are. See if there's a church in the area, because you know you're not seeing one on the map. So it's a way to get around the institutions. In some ways, I've been encouraging laymen to start their own churches. You don't need a seminary degree to start a church. In fact, I'm figuring out now that, based on my experience too, it's probably counting against you more than anything else to have a seminary degree. You have to kind of go through seminary the same way you would go through any secular university, with knowing what you believe first. And those who don't, who weren't solidified in that, ended up getting somewhat indoctrinated, unfortunately. And so sometimes your local, carpenter, or you know, I don't know, a rancher or something, could be, who just loves the Lord, he's read his Bible for years, may be a better option than, you know, a seminary grad who's never had maybe a lot of real life experience. That's not across the board. I'm not bashing people who go to seminary. Believe me, I'm not. I went. But what I'm encouraging people to network with each other and find people of like-minded faith, because I realize I get the emails all the time from you guys. Last year was rough, and you realized really three things: through the COVID lockdowns, where churches in some cases were locking down for months. Some of them are still locked down. Then you had the BLM protest, and some churches wanted to get on board with that, and or others. A lot of the more conservative churches who didn't want to get on board just didn't even mention it. Maybe a tendency to just not really think through what their laymen are facing, and so going through the Bible but not really addressing what's right in front of us, addressing the questions that laymen are having. And then you had the election, and that just opened a lot of people's eyes to where many pastors' priorities, unfortunately, were. So you're churchless now, a lot of you, or you're just driving long distances to find churches. And so I want to give you a tool that can help you guys connect with one another. And that's what we're doing. That's the mission with that. So thank you for all the patrons who are beta testing that. Thank you for all those who have supported me and some of my efforts. And I'm going to give you a few other things that are going on. I should mention this. One idea I have, we haven't started towards this, but maybe having a Discerning Christians conference. And I might crowdsource that later in the year. We'll probably have to find a state like Florida that's actually open, but we'll have to divide the work up, find some people who are willing to volunteer to help put something like this together. But I think it's necessary, and there's some voices that I think are really good on some of these subjects. Some of these subjects you all have questions about, but you're not getting a lot of answers on. And I'd love to get us all in a room for mutual encouragement and education, but more so the encouragement. That's why we have conferences, sharing of resources. So I'm thinking through that. That's probably something more in the spring that I'm going to start looking at. I think by then we'll know kind of more what the fall is going to look like in the spring. You know, by then the Biden administration will be doing whatever they're going to do, and we'll probably get at least somewhat of a sense, I'm hoping. I don't know. We could have another emergency and, you know, in their minds, fake emergency, and then we all have to, you know, shelter in place or something. But anyways, thinking through that, some other things that are going on. Today's actually a writing day for me. So after I'm done with this video, I'm gonna keep plugging away. I've been pretty negligent over the past few weeks because I've had a number of other projects, but I'm gonna get back to writing a book against social justice, more of an apologetics book. And I'm on chapter 2 right now. I've been on chapter 2 for 2 months, so we're gonna get to hopefully chapter 3 by the end of this week. And I'm expecting it to probably be, I don't know, 7-8 chapters or so. But if I really put my nose to the grindstone, I can get this done in a month and then probably out to you in 2 months. It's just there's a lot of things going on. So I hope you all enjoyed the little kind of almost like a mini doc about Tim Keller I put out there. If that's the kind of content you like, you know, let me know. I'm trying to put my efforts into the places where they're going to bear the most fruit. And I did a poll on Twitter and on Facebook, or YouTube, and it looks like people really like that kind of stuff. They like the political and social commentary first, which I'm going to give you in a minute, but you all like the historical stuff as well. And so I think that's actually indicative of something. There are some men, you can follow men who are able to exegete a passage, right? But there's a demand for people who not only can exegete a passage, but also apply a passage. And that requires understanding something about life and having actually kind of a bird's eye view of the time in which we live, where it's going, how knowing something about history, knowing something about philosophy. We're lacking that big time right now in Christian conservative circles. And I think that's my just theory, that's why people like that kind of content, at least judging from that poll. Other things going on today, right now, I'm pretty certain, right this instance, the editor for the Nini's Deli documentary is hard at work. We're putting this thing together. We're getting it out to you as fast as we can. And we got other ideas for other documentaries that could be done. And I think I'm going to be taking some steps, I think. One of the steps is I'm going to really reduce significantly my business income. I'm actually going to just probably keep like 2 accounts, and that's going to be so minimum, it's almost like a side hobby. And I'm going to start devoting more time, at least for now, to this issue of social justice and evangelicalism, but even more broadly speaking, as we head towards this great reset, and we're kind of already in it, answering some of the questions that Christians have, trying to build opposition networks that are willing to oppose, willing to name names, so important. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to do. And I'm also, even if we don't have full funding, I think I'm just going to take a step forward. And as soon as we're done editing this, I'm going to have the guys who are helping me out start traveling and doing some more work on some other documentaries that we have ideas for that we think would be very beneficial for you and for everyone. So a little bit about kind of what I've been up to, what you can expect for the next few months to a year. Other things, I wanted to comment on some things and give you the main thing I'm probably going to be working towards is why we're seeing kind of what we're seeing. And I have to be careful how I go about this, but we're seeing something that parallels in my mind, something that happened in Germany in the 1930s. And in regards to the church, because I've had to study this fairly extensively. Not, you know, I'm not going to say I'm a world expert or anything like that, but I've had to read a number of books about the church, primary sources about the church, in Germany. And so I want to kind of draw some parallels, just point out some things that are similar and concerning, and then give you kind of what I think would be what a better way might be. And so we're going to be kind of working towards that. But I saw this morning on Twitter, Phil Vischer, you know, VeggieTales guy, he has gone hard left. I'm not sure. I haven't done all the research on him. I'm not sure exactly how that happened or if he was always there. I tend to think he was not always there. I think this is fairly recent. But he put out this whole thing, this list of, from the 1920s, things evangelicals have been fearful of. And so he talks about, you know, the modernist controversy and evolution and then communism's in there and critical race theory. And then throughout the years, you know, all these things that evangelicals have been afraid of. And his point is that God doesn't give us a spirit of fear. We're not supposed to be afraid. And this is, evangelicals are their own, I forget what the word he used, but they're basically their own fear mongers. They're scaring themselves. These things aren't really threats. Evolution isn't really a threat. Communism really isn't a threat. Critical race theory really isn't a threat. You just need something to fear. And I've been in some academic, evangelical academic settings for the past like 10 years in various capacities at various places, by the way. I'm not new to this kind of thinking, especially among historians, and I can't go through all the reasons for this. I mean, there's a lot of development that has happened. I do think George Marsden, to a lesser extent, has something to do with this, but I think Mark Knoll does, Thomas Kidd to some extent, John Fee, and these guys are the moderates. These guys are like they're not as extreme as like Jamar Tisby and some of the newer quote unquote historians. They're not really historians. That's part of this. The problem with this is that I think Marsden was. I think though what that whole kind of reformed ish historic. I don't know what you even want to call it. They're kind of like anti. They're anti-populist American religious right stuff. Those guys were, and they wanted to take this very intellectual approach in their minds to the history of evangelicalism, and so they've been responsible for writing a lot of the modern histories that are used. And there's some good things in them. I'm not bashing all of it, but the people that have followed in their footsteps have kind of gone three more steps than they are, and they are taking some things that. Have been said about evangelicals, like really since the religious right, that they're just these fundamentalist fear-mongering people, and they're taking that like three extra steps and basically putting them on Adorno's F scale. Like they're basically two steps away from becoming a Nazi. That's what an evangelicalist is today. And the interesting thing is this is the narrative that's being promoted at the institutions that these evangelicals are funding. So it's like, you know, the almost Nazis, right, are funding people to tell them that they're almost Nazis, and they're eating it up. Like, it doesn't make sense. But I just wanted to let you guys know, this has been in academic settings for a long time. It's people like Phil Vischer are making this narrative popular now. And let me just poke a few holes in it for you real quick. Even if you don't know anything about history, it should be pretty simple for you just to respond to something like that with, are you fearful of evangelicals? You know, why are you saying these things? Are they boogeymen to you? Because you're making them out like they're cartoon characters, which for Phil Vischer isn't that hard, I guess. But they're these cartoony kind of just bigot hate mongers. What are you afraid of? Why are you talking about them? Why even give them the time of day? God told you not to have a spirit of fear, right? So you could kind of go that direction, even if you don't know anything about history. You just say, well, the very thing you're accusing them of, you're doing to them. The other thing, though, just a few things to point out about this narrative. Number one, it starts in the 1920s. It starts with the modernist controversy, and anyone knows, you know, Orthodox Christianity, including evangelicalism, goes beyond that. You can trace it back even farther. You can even go back to England, go back to the Puritans. You can go at the very least, to the First and Second Great Awakenings and say there's evangelicalism there. And people like Thomas Kidd and George Marsden never really had a problem with that. There's a difference between evangelicalism and neo-evangelicalism. Carl Henry's evangelicalism was kind of a response to fundamentalism. But if we're talking, and sometimes we'll shorthand just call that evangelicalism. I know this is confusing for some of you, but actual evangelicalism, if we're going to use the most popular definitions of it, it goes back to, at the very least, the First Great Awakening. And so it's interesting that they oftentimes, people like Phil Vischer this morning, for instance, want to start the narrative of evangelicalism as being birthed in like 1920s in reaction to evolution. And before that, I guess there weren't evangelicals. So the scope of that kind of an interpretation is just way off in my mind. Other things that we should note, some of these things that were evangelicals were afraid of, like evolution, like communism, like critical race theory, there's actually reasons to be afraid of those things in some sense. I mean, there's a reason Paul went after the philosophies of his time. It's just kind of like, I guess my question would be like, why is that wrong to be against those things? And you'll see with the left, they kind of, everything post-World War II leftism, at least, everything seems to relate back to Nazism. Nazism is the threat, and everyone that we don't like is in danger of becoming a Nazi in two steps or less. And that's why you'll hear these pejoratives like, you're a neo-Confederate, you're a Christian nationalist, and you think of whatever pejoratives you want to think about. They use these terms because they're way, in America, it's hard to call people Nazis, regular, ordinary Americans. But if you can say that, you know, they're a populist national Trump supporter, and that's like being a Nazi, then you can kind of make that attachment. And so that's what they keep doing. You know, they did this with the Tea Party. As soon as the Tea Party was formed, within like a few months, the Don't Tread on Me flag is racist, the Tea Party's racist, even though it was just about, you know, accountability with the budget. That's really the main issue that the Tea Party had. So this is kind of working off of Adorno's F scale, this idea that, you know, if you love your parents too much, you could have Nazi tendencies. And it's a way for the left to just tar and feather anyone who doesn't fit their socialist mold. And it's been going on for a while. But Christian nationalists, now this is the newest version of it. Now forget the fact that Nazis would have hated Christian quote-unquote nationalists. And they did. forget the fact that... you know, if you look even at like, you know, Hitler's writings and Mein Kampf and stuff, he praises Lincoln. You know, the Confederates, you know, we're jumping now regions and we're jumping across history, which is a dangerous thing to do in some ways. But the Confederates of the 1860s in the United States would have been totally opposed to the political theory of the Nazis. The Nazis were consolidators. Into a modern state, you know, get rid of the Weimar Republic. We don't want that. Confederates were decentralizers. So all that to say that it's a stupid historical narrative when you start trying to come up with all these other categories to make them Nazis. And then so you can vilify them. That's what we see going on. And it's been going on since at least the 60s, this kind of thing. The Frankfurt School was the one, they were the ones that really started this kind of thinking or at least made it popular. And so so that's another hole that I find in it. It's cartoonish, so overly simplistic. It gets the scope wrong. And then it also just, it doesn't interact with the charge that these are actually legitimate fears. Communism is a legitimate fear. So is evolution, Darwinian evolution. And they have led to some bad things, those ideas. And then, of course, last but not least, it's just hypocritical because just about every group has things that they're afraid of. If you stand for anything, there's going to be things you stand against that you want to keep from and prevent from being popular or having control. And the left is, like I just said, with everything's a Nazi, they have their own groups they vilify all the time. That's the history of the left. Anyway, there's a lot of hypocrisy in that kind of an error. Don't fall for it. A lot of people are falling for it right now. People who have not thought through it, and that's sad. We got to help people think through some of this. So I wanted to mention that. Now, the main thing that I wanted to talk about today is, and I have to be sort of careful of how I go about this, because I'm not trying to shoot at any. This is going to be taken wrong by some, and so I need to say up front, I am very grateful for men who are trying. Anyone who's trying to take any kind of stand against the social justice movement, I'm grateful for you. Not going to rain on your parade if that's truly what you're doing. I do see some weaknesses, though, kind of broadly speaking, and I want to go back to Germany in the 1930s, and maybe I'll do some episodes where I can give you all the primary sources so you see what I'm talking about, but let me give you the overview. There were two movements in Christianity that formed as a result of Nazism. One of them you're familiar with, probably, called the Confessing Church. Oftentimes, Dietrich Bonhoeffer is the hero, and he was involved in a plot to assassinate Hitler, and we like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, right? And then the other side of it, which is probably a movement you're not familiar with, is called the German Christian Movement. Now, we see both of these movements kind of being paralleled today. The German Christian movement is very much like the woke church today, or the social justice church. Both of them are unofficial state churches. And then the Confessing Church is very much like the more conservative church today. And you can start thinking of some of the groups, and I'm debating whether I should even throw names out there. I think everyone kind of knows kind of what groups I'm referring to, but there's kind of an effort to be against the social justice movement, but not to be too political, to just sort of basically to be against it in an ecclesiastical sense, but not in a political theory or magisterial or public theology sense. So that's kind of, by public theology, I mean, applying biblical truth to the arena of not just culture, but politics more generally, and the office of the civil magistrate. So one person I think that doesn't fit into that category would be like someone like a Doug Wilson, who he does think in not just the ecclesiastical category, but also in the category of what does God expect of Christians in a civil society? What does he expect of the civil magistrate? That kind of thing. So that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about are other than the mainstream kind of evangelical reformed-ish groups that are trying to take a stand. So going back to Germany in the 1930s and 40s the Confessing Church was very hampered by pietism, neo-orthodoxy, and so they could not really firmly defend the truth. They just didn't have an epistemology that helped them do that, because it was so based on this personal kind of pietistic faith. They were also very, and here's where I see a parallel, they were very concerned about ecclesiology, and that's kind of where their opposition ended. So Bonhoeffer is somewhat of an exception to this, but most of the Confessing Church did not have a huge problem. I need to backtrack. Many of the people in the Confessing Church did not have a problem with the Nazis' political agenda necessarily, what they knew of it in the 1930s. They had a problem, and this is where the Confessing Church took their stand, if you want to call it that. They had a problem with the Nazis infringing on the church. So, you can do whatever you want with the government. Go, invade some countries, I guess. I don't know. You can be anti-Jewish. Many of them were. They were anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic. They thought that, they wanted to even, I have quotes from Confessing Church leaders saying that the Jews are a problem. I'm glad the government's, addressing this issue. But they had a problem as soon as the Nazis wanted to come in their church and say, well, take that cross down, put a swastika up there, put Mein Kampf in there in the place where the Bible used to be. Like, these are the kinds of things that made them upset, nervous. Hey, don't tell us what to do inside our church. And so broadly speaking, that was the issue that the Confessing Church as a whole kind of had. It was, don't infringe on our ecclesiology. We are the church. We are an institution. You do not get to dictate to us what we are, who we are, what we do. And they're right about that. We see the same kind of thing today, though. We see the conservatives tend to want to say, hey, government, you can't tell us, now that many of them now are starting to figure out, at least, many shut down initially. And then now they're starting to come around and say, oh, wait a minute, hey, the government, wait a minute, what are they doing here? you know, this isn't even a huge, like a real pandemic. Why is the government infringing on our ability to meet, especially when liquor stores can be open and abortion clinics? And then it's kind of, so they're starting to put two and two together. And you saw, I'll just put one name out there. John MacArthur is a good example of this. Someone who initially shut down, gave Romans 13 as his reason for why they had to. And after a few months, finally said, no, we don't have to do that. And then kind of took a courageous stand that we are all supporting him for, that I was overjoyed to see. And now he, if you listen to what he says about Romans 13, he now says, well, you know, that doesn't mean that the government has authority over the church. Well, it kind of did before, but now it doesn't. And I think, and I think I've talked about it on the podcast, why I think many pastors are going through this. We've never had to face some of these questions in our country like this, and now we're having to face them. And some pastors are working through it, and they're coming out the other end, and they're realizing some things. But most of the opposition, like the confessing church in Germany, is from an ecclesiastical vantage point. They're not combating the social justice religion with a robust public theology, with an understanding of what God requires of the civil magistrate, with an understanding of what the purpose of government is. They're not being prophetic in that sense. Now, I don't encourage anyone you need to study. In fact, I should have brought it. I have a book I'm going through right now that's specifically on this topic. I'll talk about it more on the podcast. It was written by, I believe it was a Puritan who wrote about the civil magistracy. And I have a number of books that touch on this. And I've read pretty extensively the Black Robe Regiment and many of those pastors and what they believed. And you can go back to the Covenanters in Scotland. I mean, we actually have a very rich history that is pretty much ignored at this point by most even Reformed evangelicals today. They're just not aware of it. And ignorance is understandable, but we can't be ignorant any longer. We're going to have to start doing some of this research from the text of Scripture, from our traditions, to see how these texts have been interpreted and applied in various situations. And that's not, in my opinion, being done right now. What's being done is the same thing the confessing church did, which is, you know, just, hey, basically government, you know, the church's role is different than the government's role. And you know, the church isn't supposed to be following the culture. I mean, that's kind of the best defense that can be leveled by most of the conservatives out there. And it's not adequate. It's actually, in my opinion, it doesn't understand culture completely either. How multifaceted culture is. How religion, you know, separating religion from culture, actually religion's part of culture. It's enmeshed in culture, not the world, not the, you know, because oftentimes culture and the world are conflated in these more conservative circles, but they're not the same thing. So if you start with a good understanding of what culture is and what God's plan for culture and for nations and for people and for the church are, I think you avoid this and you're able to have a very robust response, which is what I've tried to do on this channel, a robust response to that movement and a biblical response as well, but not just an ecclesiastic, ecclesiocentric response, because that's not going to work. It did not work in Germany. It's not going to work here. And one of the reasons it didn't work in Germany is because of there's a kind of a naivete to it, that the government is just, the modern state is just going to leave the church alone. If we can just convince them to leave us alone, you're not dealing with the government. You're dealing with an opposing religion. Nazism was a religion in and of itself. That's the thing that I think many of us miss. Nazism was a holistic, there's nothing outside of Nazism. It's all encompassing. And so the church is part of that. And so you have to defeat the ideology itself from the root. You can't say, well, it's fine, you do your thing, but leave us alone. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. You know, let the church be the church. No, they're not going to let the church be the church. You don't understand. So that's what I see kind of going on in that world. Now, and one of the things, I saw a clip the other day that wasn't, it wasn't like totally off, but it was at a conference that it was some more conservative people, and the clip was, it was of a pastor going after like discernment ministries, and basically saying, well, you know, discernment ministries, if you're not attached to a church, if you're not, if you're just a guy on the internet, then, you know, you're thriving on controversy. Your success is when you're able to be controversial and stir up trouble. You're just stirring up trouble is what you're doing. And I've seen this before. And the people that usually advocate this, I don't think I've ever seen them name who they're talking about. But they're very adamant about it. And that's, you know, that's a huge problem right now. And I wanted to make this point. It is very possible that there are quote unquote ministries out there that are not attached to local church accountability, and they're just trying to thrive on controversy. And okay, that's very possible. I mean, I'm thinking of a few, they're very small platforms that I could think of this being a problem in. I don't know whether people like that are talking about me or others. They never name who they're talking about. I mean, it doesn't apply to me. I'm a member in good standing at two different churches. I travel a lot, just so people know, and I go back and forth between New York and where I live currently in Virginia. And at one church, I have the sanction, the unofficial sanction of the leaders there, and I've certainly helped them through some of these questions. At the other church, as far as I know, there's no problem with anything that I'm doing, and I'm constantly making it very clear to leaders at both churches. I've taken a break from the trajectory of my life, which was to go into pastoral ministry. I'm taking a break to deal with this issue because I think it needs to be dealt with. If you ever see anything that you're concerned about, you know, come and talk to me about it. I believe in that authority. I think it's very important to have that authority in your life. And I certainly have it. And I'd say on a weekly basis, I talk to one church leader, sometimes two, about what I'm going through and how I want to respond and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think that critique, if that kind of critique is supposed to be leveled at someone like me, I don't think it applies. But I don't know. Maybe it's not about me. Maybe there's other people with small platforms who it's talking about. But the point I really want to make is that that kind of a critique is against people with really small platforms. And it's like going after a mouse when there's an elephant in the room. And the reason that that some of these quote-unquote ministries even exist is because, and this is where my heart kind of breaks, it's because pastors are not, by and large, doing their job. I'm not accusing anyone in particular, but I'm saying there's a demand for people that speak the truth and will oppose evil, false teachers, etc., because pastors aren't doing it. And I've tried to point this out, even within the last week, on social media, that there's a number of pastors and who have no problem naming names when it comes to the prosperity gospel. They'll go after Benny Hinn and Joel Osteen, and the list goes on. People that were close to the president, you know, they will go after them, brutally go after them. And they will be silent when it comes to the social justice preachers. I'm not going to say anything about Jamar Tisby, if you want to call him a preacher. I don't know what he is. I mean, I don't know what Benny Hinn is either, though. So, I mean, you know, they're not going to go after Phil Vischer. They're not going to, and now, I mean, that list is expanding. They're not going to go after Lingan Duncan. They're not going to go after, in my opinion, Mark Dever. They're not going to, I mean, these are the more moderates in a sense, but they're, you know, I've shown you some of the things that they've said and have said. They're also social justice preachers at this point. They're not going to go after Tim Keller. They're not going to go after, you know, by name, they're not going to go after the professors at Southern Seminary who are pumping this stuff out, or have pumped it out. And the list just goes on and on and on. You know that it's an overwhelming list of names that I could off the top of my head just give you of people who are promoting the social justice religion and ingratiating themselves to the state. So that mixture of the state power with the social justice religion is exactly what the German Christians tried to do. They tried to say, hey, we're Christians, we're going to keep our Christian identity, and we can help you, state. We think what you're doing is good in Germany, right? What you're doing against the Jews, it's the anti-Semitism, that's a good thing. We're going to help you out. We're going to make sure, I'm going to show you guys, I'm going to virtue signal to you, you Nazis, that we in the church also are going to purge, and this is literally what happened, guys. We're going to purge our hymn books. We're going to take out A Mighty Fortress. We're going to take out anything that could be referencing anything pro-Jewish or pro-Old Testament even. We're going to we're going to go through scripture and we're going to interpret it in such a way that the Old Testament is this Jewish thing that doesn't apply, and we're going to downplay it. And actually, towards the end of World War II, they were going to purge the Bible. We're going to actually come up with their own Bible. That's what they did. They tried to ingratiate themselves to basically parallel everything that the Nazis were saying and find a parallel in the church. And you think it might be silly, that sounds stupid. They were not dumb people. If you look at some of the writings of those guys, they have scholarship. They go into detail about the Aryan Jesus, and they try to prove it with the best scholarship of the time. That's exactly what we have now. We have a bunch of educated fools who are just like the German Christians, ingratiating themselves to the state narrative, which is now the state narrative, guys. If you've looked at what the Biden administration is doing, it's exactly, oh, look at all the policies that he's already put in place, the executive orders, the Equality Act or something like that, you know, incorporating LGBT and that whole panoply into the civil rights legislation. You know, look at what he's done with the transgender bathroom issue. Picked up right where the Obama administration left off. He banned the 1776 project, which I wasn't a big fan of anyway, but he's doing it for different reasons. Got rid of that. They're going to start teaching critical race theory to the military. Look at what's happening and look at what the church is doing in response to that. The woke church. The social justice church is doing exactly what the German Christian church did. They are ingratiating themselves to the state. It's a survival mechanism. And it's the formation of a new state religion. That's what they are. It's a state religion. It's critical race theory isn't the issue really here. It's a state religion. And on the confessing church side, aka the more conservative Christians, more conservative churches, they still think that, you know, discernment ministries that are pointing this out are such a big problem right now. That needs to be dispelled with. They still think that the problem somehow is, you know, the church is just trying to be like the culture, or they think that this is just an extension of the seeker-sensitive movement, or, you know, this goes back to, you know, whatever. This is, reform guys like to blame Finney for everything, you know. It's not Finney, guys. I mean, I could see why there's like a very slim thread where you could say that because you want to appeal to people who are seeking or whatever, in your minds, you know, people who aren't Christians, you're going to try to look like the world. I can sort of see that, but that's not exactly all that's going on here at all. That's not a full picture of it at all. Although, yes, there is a side to that. There is some legitimacy to that idea. This is a survival mechanism. This is a formation of a new religion. That's what's going on completely. And it's not because they're centered on the seeker out there. You know, it's they're centered on a modern state with the force to destroy everything in its path, and they don't want to be destroyed. So this happened already in history. It's happened not just in Nazi Germany, I'm sure. I'm sure it's happened in many other instances. That's just the one I'm probably most familiar with that would parallel this. And I think we got to get our priorities straight. So here's the answer, in my opinion. Here's the answer. This is why I want to do a conference at some point to get some voices platformed who I think are doing good jobs, but they have smaller platforms. The answer is we have to have a very robust public theology, understanding of the magistrate, understanding of how even Romans 13 has been traditionally interpreted throughout church history. We have to get away from this idea that we should interpret the Bible in just a vacuum. We actually do have wisdom from the ages that we can look to. It's not the authority, but it helps. It's like what C.S. Lewis said about reading old books. It helps us get outside of the place that we're in right now in history, and helps us see from another vantage point sometimes. And we have a robust, rich history to go to learn how some of these passages have been interpreted over the course of history. So we need to be doing that, which I'm dedicated to doing. In fact, we have a few episodes coming up. I have one with Thomas Accord, that you're going to enjoy. You're going to want to, it's going to be really eye-opening, I think, for some of you. It's going to sort of be a paradigm shift and help you think about culture and place and who your neighbor is in a different way. And I think this is way more important than reactionary battling to critical race theory. We got to be for something. And I'll tell you what I'm for. I'm for my family. I'm for, and my family is influenced by it, by Christianity. It worked itself into the traditions and the manners of my family, and the songs and everything. And I inherited that. And when I start a family, I'm going to pass some of that stuff down. I'm not starting with a blank slate. And so, some of you who didn't grow up in Christian homes, you're going to have to be. You get creative, or you look to what other families are doing, and you. But the point being that you're attaching yourself to something that it's tradition. It goes back. I'm for Western civilization, Christian culture, Christian influence culture. No, that doesn't mean everyone's a Christian in it. It means that Christian principles have worked themselves into law and into all these other arenas. I'm for institutions that. Some of those are defunct now, like I was in the Boy Scouts and, I'm not for what the Boy Scouts currently are, so there's certain things I'm not, but I'm for, I'm for young men understanding what it means to be a man. And when I have a son, I'll probably be involved with taking him camping and whatever organization does that. I'm for the country that I live in. I'm for the place that I come from. I'm for my grandparents and the places that they came from. And I'm for the principles that made the country that I live in the way it is, the good and true and valuable things. I'm for honoring the memory of those who fought with valor and with bravery and with courage. And I'm for passing down those heroes to my children. I'm for the Bible, specifically, and teaching that to my children. I could keep going. There's just so many things I'm for. I'm for carrying on, an understanding of how to defend my family and using firearms and defense, mechanisms in a way that's responsible. There's all sorts of things that we probably don't think of on a daily basis that we're actually all for. And those are the things that are worth defending. You're for your wife, you're for your pets even, the blessings God's given you. Defend those things. That's what I want to be doing. We're going to defend those things. We're not just going to go back to, let's react against critical race theory. Let's react against LGBTQ. Those things are attacking us. It's a culture siege. They're coming after who we are and trying to deconstruct everything we believe to the core. So let's be for those things that they're trying to deconstruct. In every arena, not just the ecclesiastical arena, not just the church. Wherefore, the true and valuable good things in every single avenue of our life. That's the answer, guys. And so I'm going to have Thomas Accord on. We're going to start the conversation on this. Not that it's already, I've already talked about it to some extent, but I think he just has a very clear way of thinking about some of these things. I'm going to have Dr. James White on, hopefully next week. We're going to talk about Romans 13. Guys, we're going to be for some things. The Discerning Christians website. It's not the anti-CRT website, right? It's the Discerning Christians website. We're for discernment, right? So yes, to be for some things means you also need to be against some things. Absolutely true. But I want to avoid what I see some conservative circles doing, which is they are, they want to be against discernment ministries, but they've kind of become their own they're their own kind of club in a way, their own discernment ministry, where anything outside of them is in error. And I've seen this tendency quite a bit. It's not everyone and I'm not accusing all conservative pastors of this or anything close to that, just so people don't misunderstand. I'm just saying I see a tendency out there. I can think of names. And I want to encourage those people because they're on our side. Even if all they understand is, we have to have a good ecclesia. Okay, good. That's a good start. Let's branch out. We need to be tackling the questions Christians actually have. Questions like, do I have to take the vaccine if the government tells me to? Do I have to submit to a president that might be illegitimate? What about all the other things that the government's going to be forcing on my business that's outside of the ecclesia? What about, the list just goes on and on, educating your children and What traditions and symbols and things should I keep? What traditions and symbols should I get rid of for the sake of not causing an offense? These questions they're not even hardly approached in a certain more conservative demographic. And it just parallels kind of what the confessing church did. And I don't want to fall into that category. So we're going to need to be more robust. And there are some groups out there that are being robust. I'll tell you what. They're not mainstream yet, but I think I think there's a demand for it. And hopefully it's not too late. You know, we always, you know, ultimately we're for the Lord. We're for the world as he created it. The natural world. We're for the natural revelation, for special revelation. And we want to defend the world as it has been created, as it is, and not the reconfiguration Satan and evil forces want to recreate the world into, something that is not in the image of God, not according to his plan. And so, and that's what we're doing. And that's what I'm going to continue to do. So I don't know. I hope that helped you guys out. This was much longer than I thought it would be. My short little podcast, my cell phone, smartphone podcasts here, but which are supposed to be short. But, you know, I hope that just helped you guys kind of get a vision for basically where I want to go, what I want to do. And look, I want to encourage the guys that might be ignorant or may not see the full picture. You know, we want to help in that as much as we possibly can. So I need to get to writing now, but hey, God bless you all. Thank you for your support once again, and I appreciate it. God bless. Bye now.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.